mother in my old clothes?
Yes, darling. You can climb the apple tree in your own yard.
Okay.
Oh, hello, Grace. How are you?
Come on, sit down. Oh, another one of those messages.
Yes.
Grace, if you don't stop selling your soul to the devil by believing in those foolish horoscopes.
What about May? And Hazel is in jail.
It's pitiful, yes. But the result of natural causes. And belief in anything else is believing in magic.
But, Laura...
And you could help the rest of us. Grace, if you'd hush and stop writing your letters, telling us all to prepare for our...
But the moon does control the tides. And nothing can live without the sun. Why shouldn't we be controlled?
Because we're reasoning human beings, silly, and not irresponsible machines.
Listen, Laura. This letter came from the Swami just an hour ago. I have to tell you. Listen, I would do anything to prevent the disasters that have come down upon you and your friends, as I would do anything to save my own life. But I can do neither, for I am helpless too. I knew too much about the heavens. They're killing me. My own horoscope shows that I am to leave this earth before July 1st.
Well, if I needed anything more than common sense to disprove your argument, that would be enough. No one is going to take his own life just to prove to 12 women that he's a good stargazer. You're deranged, Grace.
This happens. If the Swami himself does die, how can we disbelieve?
Okay. Are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, one of the few people I know who is certified to commit existentialism with Ajax Farrell and Fiction House comic books. And if you haven't read, I just have to tell the listeners, Michael, if you haven't read Comics from the Gone World, your volumes and the other... Well, the other times you have dipped into the Iger Studios files and sort of gone your own way. Comics from the Gone World, I just can't recommend them highly enough. Plenty of laughs. I mean, there's everything from, you know, references to Jean-Paul Sartre to cops eating donuts at every opportunity. You cover the waterfront, Michael.
Well, it's only the astute listeners of the Forgotten Horrors podcast would pick up on the name Ajax Farrell.
That's right.
And, you know, all the better for it. It's just Jerry Iger told me that he, this was during the 70s when he was kind of resurgent as a gray eminence at the comics conventions.
Mm-hmm.
He said his great inspiration was Monogram and PRC Pictures.
Perfect.
And of course, because Jerry, you know, the Iger Shop was doing a regular monthly horror series, 10 years before Bill Gaines purported to have invented horror comics with Tales from the Crypt.
That's true.
And it wasn't a self-contained series. It was a feature in another magazine, in a general interest magazine, but it ran, and it ran, and it ran, and of course that was the Iger Shop, the Jerry Iger Shop.
Mm-hmm.
And by golly, if they didn't end up riding that new 50s horror comics bandwagon by recycling their old Ghost Gallery stories in a brand new title called Ghost Comics.
And of course Ghost Gallery was in Fiction House, it wasn't Rangers. What was it in?
It was in Jumbo.
In Jumbo.
Jumbo Comics, which originally was indeed Jumbo, an outsized comic book, but when it shrunk back to conventional dimensions, they kept the title because, you know, hell, it had a jumbo attitude.
Yes, and of course, most of the time, it was the cover feature was Sheena.
Sheena, Queen of the Jungle.
Which was a Jerry Iger creation. But occasionally, I think you told me the other day when we were talking that they would occasionally have Ghost Gallery on the cover.
Oh, yeah, and some striking covers. Not to digress too much from the point of the session here,
right.
But this new book that I'm preparing at IDW Publishing will be a kind of a best of ghost gallery. Mm-hmm. And boy, are we ever struggling to reclaim those lovely stories. A lot of recognizable artists working anonymously. You know, Feldstein
in the
is there.
Shop, of course.
In the Iger shop. Mm-hmm. You know, $10 a page and all the humble pie you can eat. And golly, those stories, they're a combination of hard-boiled detective stories.
Yes.
With ghosts.
Yes.
And
yes.
All the voluptuous women you could
handle.
Fit onto one page, and they do pop off the page, which was an Iger trademark.
Now, does Harry Harrison ever work for Iger?
I believe so.
Well, Harry Harrison, the one time that I spent any time with him, of course, was when he had been reborn as a fine science fiction writer.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing a panel together, and he asked me to come up to his room and visit after we were done. And he started telling me about those days in the immediately following World War II. And all of these guys had the GI Bill, so they were going to art school. And he said they'd all go over to one person's apartment. And they'd set up these penciled pages all around, and teams of these inkers would go after the pages. And
the person
who got finished the quickest got all of his drinks bought for him.
Holy moly.
So, you know, there wasn't a lot of thought about art as so much as swiftness and free alcohol.
I've always pictured those Iger shop wage slaves as standing on a corner holding up a sign that says, "We'll draw for booze money." Harrison, I think I've run across some Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how far back to trace him because anonymity was the order of the day.
Of course.
But he has been identified with as a collaborator with Al Feldstein. At the Iger shop during the horror, romance, westerns, etc. period of the post-war years.
Prior to his working, of course, with Wally Wood.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And,
well, you know, a couple of years ago, Jack Bender, who you know Jack and Carol Bender.
Yeah.
Jack was instrumental in getting Jerry Iger inducted into the Oklahoma Cartoonists Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Because he spent his youth in Oklahoma.
Sort of a Yiddish redneck.
Yes, he was kind of a Yiddish redneck.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly right. Yeah. All right. So from segueing now, and by the way, I think the whole idea of Monogram and PRC, I just recently rewatched Detour, and there is just this kind of this sweaty nihilism that in these Iger shop stories that feels like Detour.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That feels like these people are being pushed along like a chip in a stream, and their fate is not their own. And they're just, like you have said, I think, a couple of times, the plots look like they were written on the back of a cocktail napkin. And so then we move. That's not much of a segue, but we do move from comic books to movies. And actually, would you say that 13 Women is a big budget movie, Michael?
It was a major studio movie.
Yes, it was Radio Pictures.
RKO Radio Pictures.
Mm-hmm. 1933.
Yes, it flopped conspicuously. Actually, it was released. Let me look at my notes here. It was
released. While you're looking at it, it was based, of course, on a book that had been a pretty good seller, as I understand.
Tiffany Thayer, who had been, of course, Tiffany Thayer, the author, shows up in earlier volumes of Forgotten Horrors.
Yes.
For example, the novel The Illustrious Corpse.
Yes, yes.
She
was a big writer of the 20s and 30s, correct?
Big time writer. 13 mm-hmm. Women. There's a companion book called 13 Men.
Mm-hmm.
Which, to my knowledge, has not been filmed. I did a random search the other day and checked the American Film Institute catalog once again. I believe 13 Women was the one that made it into filming, but flopped conspicuously at the box office.
Was it not really cut up and re-edited, and there was a lot more going on in the picture that was excised before the final release?
It had the same fate that Ernest Shudsock and Marion Cooper's Most Dangerous Game had.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the film would have run nearly an hour and a half if it had been left intact.
And what is it, just a little over, what, an hour, like 70, 75 minutes, isn't
an
it?
An hour and 15 minutes, you know. Yes. It cracks right along, and it, honestly, I don't see that it's lost any impact in the drastic editing. They weren't trying to placate the censors. They were trying to placate the general public, which objected to previews as being just too sadistic. Well,
too sadistic. That was the problem with it?
It's still pretty much too sadistic
as
it
exists. Actually, you know, and when you get the kids, anytime you get kids threatened, even one that's as annoying as the child that we have in 13 Women.
Oh, yeah.
That ups the ante quite a little bit.
Yeah.
The whole thing with the kid, actually, it's the kid that's, I mean, the women pretty much because of, and I think it's wonderful, the whole idea of the power of suggestion.
Yeah.
You know, the women really drop because of the power of suggestion. The child doesn't have that. They're just going after the child.
The child comes near a poisoning, and of course the poisoning is part of a general campaign of revenge.
Yes.
Good time to briefly synopsize the bring in our old pal Frank Synopsis.
Mm-hmm.
The motivation is bigotry.
Yes.
Myrna Loy, who often played Asian characters before she became a prominent comedian of the screwball romantic
yes.
comedy sector.
Thanks to the Thin Man, largely, right?
The Thin Man, yes. Mm-hmm. She plays this very alluring but cold alumnus of an exclusive school where she was blackballed by the Caucasian women.
By the popular kids.
Yeah, by the popular kids. She was the misfit. I think she's probably nicer in aspect, very appealing, though cold and reptilian. I suspect she was probably a pretty nice kid before she tasted the fruits of discrimination.
And Irene Dunne plays the, the person who was sort of the head of this group of women who stayed together, corresponding and things after their time at this college. And Irene Dunne is the one who has the child. And it's essentially, as you say, it's a revenge story that with elements, I think, of police procedural in it, as with Ricardo Cortez when he finally comes into the picture.
But, what a great leading man he was.
Oh, he was just absolutely, and he's very good in this. And Myrna Loy is stunning. Your reptilian is a good way to put it.
Well, she was daughter of Fu Manchu in MGM's Mask of Fu Manchu.
Was that just the year before, wasn't
approximately
it?
The same period of time. I believe the year after.
A year after, okay.
And, ooh-wee, is she ever amazing. It's like works from behind the scenes until she gets up the gumption to do confrontations.
Mm-hmm.
Has this good old Henry Gordon, the consummate Hollywood grouch.
Right.
I would say bogus Swami. And of course the alumni of the exclusive school all think it's such a lark to have their horoscopes told by the Swami, never knowing that this Swami is under the hypnotic spell of their former classmate,
mm-hmm.
who's using him to predict doom for them, thereby, power of suggestion, setting him up for disaster.
Have I lost the power to divine the stars?
No, Swami. But you must send the letter. For the sake of those 12 women who wrote the round robin asking for their horoscopes. They were schoolgirls together. Their lives form one chain of destiny. 12 women who believe. Don't destroy their faith in the occult, Swami.
What is in that brain of yours? Your eyes. We've met before. Of that I'm certain.
Not on this earth. Were we lovers in another incarnation, Swami? Tell me.
And that power of suggestion, I'm just wondering if in the early 1930s that was a bigger thing or a bigger topic than it was now, because it does, in this day and age, does stretch the credulity a bit.
You find that, yeah, it's funny. The film holds up beautifully well, although I think we're less accustomed in the present culture to buy into such outlandish concepts.
Yes.
But of course, you see that element showing up in, films like The Spider.
Yes.
Of the same period. You see hypnotic powers brought to bear in a lot of, Fu Manchu basically scares his captives to death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because both of those films with Myrna Loy are prior to the time that the production code really gets teeth in 1934.
Yeah, this is 2 years before the Legion of Decency sunk its lunch hooks into the Hollywood establishment.
Right.
Although they were lurking. I mean, the seeds were there, and censorship was already in place, but there were few problems with occasional profanity or nudity or voluptuosity.
Yes, yes. I will, if I can digress, I remember we have, of course, I'm from Tulsa, which is the home of Oral Roberts University, and they put their own TV station on the air several years ago, and they decided one of the things they would do would be show a film every afternoon, and they bought a very cheap package of, I guess, mostly public domain films, but certainly films from the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them, such as I Cover the Waterfront and the Costello, I think it's Costello murder case.
Mm-hmm.
I guess figuring that they were from the 30s, so they should be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And there was all kinds of shenanigans going on. There was all kinds of language. There were a lot of dams and hells in some of the pictures,
good,
which they never watched. And I it always kind of tickled me to see something like that on the Oral Roberts channel, because prior to 1934, you're right, there were a lot of things. There were people certainly living together without benefit of clergy.
Mm-hmm.
There were things like, there were some very cringe-inducing things, as we get in 13 Women. And this is a really, it holds up well, and we've talked about this, the idea that it's almost a template in some ways for films like Terror Train specifically.
Terror Train in particular from the 70s.
Yeah. But also just the whole idea of all of these victims that are being stalked by someone, and they finally find out why and what they all have in common and all that sort of thing. And it's almost a predecessor to the slasher film.
A real template there. It's like, why are these horrible things happening? Well, I'll tell you, it's because you excluded me.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, we've talked often about the harmful effects of gossip, ostracism, banishment, where you might think you're getting rid of what appears to be an annoyance, but you're actually setting yourself up for the potential of revenge.
That's right. That's right. And also, we might add snark to that list, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a great opening sequence in this picture. And I was thinking, about what time did Freudian psychology become the vogue for the first time in America?
I'd have to look that up.
Yeah, I'd have to look that up, too.
I really would.
This whole power of suggestion thing seems to have at its base some sort of psychological underpinning.
Mm-hmm.
to make it seem scientific, you know, because it is a very strong element of the plot.
We'll have to put a footnote in on that on Mr. Freud when we go into the Forgotten Horrors podcast book.
There you go. I think that would probably be a good idea. Well, should we talk just for a moment about poor Peg Entwistle, who does a very good job in this picture?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And she is, for those who don't know, she was the first, I guess, and maybe one of the only, well, of course one of the only, people to jump off the Hollywood sign.
Yeah, she was. There are many such petty tragedies,
mm-hmm,
in the film industry. You consider that maybe one in hundreds of thousands would rush to Hollywood thinking breakthrough imminent,
mm-hmm,
and wind up, maybe getting to be a crowd extra.
Right.
I suspect not nearly all of those disappointed souls took their disappointment to that extreme. Yeah, Peg Entwistle, Welsh, she was Welsh.
Yes.
Thought, like a lot of poor souls do, that making movies would be all glamour and fame and you know, champagne for breakfast and all that. Entertainment is hard work if you do it right.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you see the dilettantes who might get famous, like, the guy from England, Lord Such. Screaming Lord Such, who learned only gradually that it ain't easy. That money might buy the best sidemen in the rock and roll racket, but it sure doesn't buy you the talent. So actually, he got quite good at it once he realized that he'd have to knuckle down.
And of course, by that time, his opportunity had pretty much passed.
His best work occurred after the shock value of his debut.
Mm-hmm. His sidemen sort of went down a little bit in terms of luminosity, I guess.
Well, yeah, it's mm-hmm. like, and you know, they're kind of like when Sting made Bring on the Night. Why is he surrounding himself with these great jazz musicians right. when he really hadn't got the chops to keep up with them, and they're not going to condescend to his level of talent.
Right, that's true. Yeah, but Peg Entwistle, you know, you look at her performance in this picture, and I don't know that I've seen her in anything else. She's certainly very pretty, very accomplished. She's a good screen presence, and yet it wasn't all that long after this film was released, or maybe even before it was released, that she committed suicide by jumping off the Hollywood sign.
Actually, she croaked herself on the 18th of September in 1932.
So it was before this was released.
And the formal release of 13 Women occurred very nearly the same time, 16th of September.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, probably the tepid reception at the box office had something to do with her.
Oh, you really think that there was a possible cause and effect thing?
Yeah, the film did not succeed commercially.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably the same kind of backlash that made Freaks such an embarrassment for MGM Pictures, mm-hmm. same general period.
Right. You wonder if perhaps also she went to the premiere and maybe her part had been drastically reduced.
That could very well be
because it was so cut up.
It is not. She was beautiful enough to have been given showcases.
Yes, she was.
And
yes, she was.
Not untalented.
No. No, she was quite good, and so I didn't realize that it was within that little length of time, between the premiere of the film and her death. I didn't realize it was that short of a time. We may never know. All right, well, tell us. Would you recommend this picture?
Invariably.
Yes.
Invariably.
Too. Me too.
It's a strong example of the kind of variations that the major studios began working as early as 1932 on the horror movie bandwagon that Universal had launched in 1931 with Dracula and Frankenstein.
Yes.
But of course, a bandwagon loses steam. There is still money to be made. But by the latter part of 1932, well, the critics are very fickle.
Mm-hmm.
The public is very fickle.
Mm-hmm.
The story, such as it is, I mean, it's not a complicated story. It's just a pageant of atrocities,
mm-hmm.
but beautifully acted. And I think, although the most of the proposed and actual victims are portrayed in generally sympathetic terms, the sympathy of the viewer goes directly to Myrna Loy's villain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh my yes. gosh, what did they do to her that she's so blasted angry?
And she is. She's really angry.
And, you don't find that kind of portrayal. That's a very courageous portrayal in defiance of vanity. although Myrna Loy is given an aspect of beauty in the film, it's not a sympathetic portrayal, and you don't find that often in a leading role.
And I guess people would say that Irene Dunne has a leading role. I know she's top billed, but she just really is not, just really can't stand, doesn't stand a chance when she's on screen with Myrna Loy.
No.
It's amazing. Irene Dunne's a huge star, you know?
Yes, with credentials in all different genres.
That's right. Yeah, I would say, I don't know how easy the film is to get, but I really enjoyed it, and it's not what you would expect. There's a modernistic aspect to it, but there's also it just goes down some pretty weird avenues. So let's talk about your rebooted is the wrong term, but Forgotten Horrors 3 we're talking about.
Oh, the new edition of Forgotten Horrors Volume 3. Well, it's got a lot of new stuff in it. It's got everything that was good about the first edition. It's got about maybe 25% less verbiage because I got on a kick against adverbs and prepositional phrases. It's like, I didn't need to say that. Why did I say that? It's just taking up space. So I think it reads more crackingly than the first edition, which was, 10 years ago?
It was. It's the first one that you asked me to come aboard and contribute to.
Right.
And that was probably maybe even more than 10 years now that I'm thinking of it.
Well, it's hard to keep track when the treadmill keeps turning.
That's exactly right. As Fred Allen said, the treadmill to oblivion. You know, but it's a great book, and you've added some material. There are some other contributors.
Oh yeah, great deal of new art. A wonderful little piece, not written by but contributed by Steve Bissett, who found late Depression period movie magazine, a fan magazine, containing a chapter on the juvenile movie production company from Texas that we had covered in Volume 2, Forgotten Horrors Number 2, but this sheds more light and it has more and better pictures. And so it's like, okay, let's put a little appendix in here. And, of course, it was Steve Bissett that not only turned this up, but also documented very nicely we're heavy into provincial movie making, as we both demonstrated. Steve had demonstrated that one of the first motion picture production companies in the United States outside Hollywood, before Hollywood, was in fact at the same town in Texas, San Antonio, in the early 1910s. And it's like, okay, so San Antonio's got quite a history.
And I've dealt with that in my book, which is still available as well on Amazon and at bookstores, Shot in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Talking about the itinerant filmmakers that would come through the cities.
Yeah, when I saw that title, I thought it was going to be about Pretty Boy Floyd.
Yeah. or any number of others. No shortage of people shot in Oklahoma.
Oh, man.
But, you know, the whole Norman film company thing out of Florida, where he would walk around with a camera and go into cities like Tulsa with a script about a high adventure train robbery and cast the mayor and all the people and say, well, we can make this film. And then he'd make the film, cut it. And I think 1912 was when the film was debuted in Tulsa. The Tulsa version of the film was debuted.
Yeah.
But no, it has. I've been enjoying Forgotten Horrors 3 very much. The new one, the new edition of it, and I would very highly recommend it. And if you're looking for something for free, you can go to your local newspaper or go online at gocomics.com and take a look at the current Alley-Oop strip.
Hot dog.
because the Benders, Jack and Carol Bender, have allowed me to once again write a plot synopsis for them, and I've got it happening in 1940s Hollywood. It's basically Alley Oop meets Dan Turner, Hollywood detective. We don't call him that, but that's who he is. And there's a lot of if there's Dan Turner fans out there, not just the Dan Turner pulp, but also the comics that I did for Eternity back in the 90s.
Oh yeah.
And also the 1990 movie Dan Turner, Hollywood Detective, I wrote with Mark Singer. You got any Dan Turner fans out there? For that matter, fans of the movie Blackmail from the late 1940s with the Turner movie from Republic. It'll be worth a look, and it doesn't cost you a red cent.
That's lovely. And Alley Oop has thrived. Oh, heck, we got more and more and more. I'm just now coming up about the halfway mark on these ghost gallery page restorations. Right. And looks like that's going to wind up as part of IDW's Chilling Archives of Horror series.
Nice. Very nice. Well, Jim Vance and I have just done our introduction of the first Bob Powell collection, the Cave Girl collection.
Yeah.
Which is going to be coming out in October, and it's available right now on Amazon for a pre-order. So, sounds like we're staying busy, and we'll be back soon with it. Maybe we can go to something in the 60s or 70s this next time, because I know we want to talk about the Boris Karloff Night World film at some point, but
yes,
maybe we ought to run a little bit forward this next time. And
if we do nonlinear thinking, it stays interesting.
Well, that's true.
And just dart about. That's the official span of Forgotten Horrors is 1929 through 1985, with some significant exceptions. And boy, that's a big old stretch of time to choose from.
It is a huge stretch of time. And, you know, we're nothing, Michael, if we're not nonlinear. So, on behalf of Michael Price and our producer, Joey Hambrick, Joey, thank you very much for this. You've done a wonderful job here. Not getting any echoes or anything tonight, so it's good. We will see you next. And thank you. Let's thank the folks. We keep getting. Joey's also running the what do you call it?
The Forgotten Horrors podcast Facebook.
Facebook.
Group. Oh, the Facebook page, of course, yes.
Again, another free thing. It costs nothing to join that page. And we've got, what, a couple hundred now?
Yes.
A very lively page.
Very, and there's always room for more, so drop on by. Thank you, Michael.
Lovely.
Bye.